May God teach you the meaning of that name, Emmanuel, God with us. Emmanuel, it is wisdom's mystery, God with us. Sages look at it and wonder. Angels desire to see it. The plumb line of reason cannot reach halfway into its depths. The eagle wings of science cannot fly so high, and the piercing eye of the vulture of research cannot see it. God with us. It is hell's terror. Satan trembles at the sound of it. His legions fly apace. The black-winged dragon of the pit quails before it. Let Satan come to you suddenly, and do you but whisper the word, God with us, and back he falls, confounded and confused. Satan trembles when he hears that name. It is the laborer's strength. How could he preach the gospel? How could he bend his knees in prayer? How could the missionary go into foreign lands? How could the martyr stand at the stake? How could the confessor acknowledge his master? How could men labor if that one word were taken away? God with us is the sufferer's comfort, is the balm of his woe, is the alleviation of his misery, is the sleep that God gives to his beloved, is the rest after exertion and toil. God with us is eternity's sonnet, is heaven's hallelujah, is the shout of the glorified, is the song of the redeemed, is the chorus of angels, and is the everlasting oratorio of the great orchestra of the sky. God with us.
Awesome, man. What a great reminder that God is with us. How awesome is it that, I mean, that was a sermon from 1854, right? Just as relevant today as it was 150 years ago. Awesome. Well, if you've got your Bibles, go ahead and grab them. We're going to be continuing on in Acts this evening. If you've got the Bibles in front of you, the wonderful whites, we're going to be on page 602. We're going to be in Acts 18. Picking back up where we have been in Paul's missionary journey, his second missionary journey. Page 602, Acts 18. And the chapters are the big numbers on there, the verses, the small numbers. We're going to be in chapter 18, verse 1. So before we jump in, I'm going to go ahead and address the elephant in the room. All right. For all you guys out there, this is what's called a suit. And I realize that if you're new here, I want to go ahead and let you know this is not the norm. Usually Lynn Gallagher is the most dressed up person because he has his shirt tucked in. So that's kind of typically the dress code here. I came straight from a wedding over here. One of the guys on staff over at Oakland Church, Joel Kaufman, he's getting married. Just got married. The reception is still going on right now. So I was there, literally got in the car and drove straight here. So again, this isn't the norm, but I do enjoy wearing a suit. So this is the second time I've gotten to wear a suit here in Orlando since I've moved here 8 months ago. I'm sure some people, especially Lynn, I'm sure, Lynn, I'm sorry to keep picking on you, but there's not many others that are over the age of 25 in here, but I'm sure Lynn remembers the day whenever it was strange not to wear a suit to church, and here we are, just flip turned upside down, and now it's weird for a guy. Anyway, don't be ashamed, or don't be shocked that I've got a suit on. Just came from a wedding. So we're going to be in Acts 18. So Paul here is just getting to a city known as Corinth. Okay, and so to backtrack kind of where we've been and where Paul has been before he gets to Corinth, he has been going from city to city preaching the gospel, and he has a common strategy as he goes into each city. He goes into the synagogues, he will reason with the Jews there, he will open up the scriptures with them, and he will say, hey, everything that you believed in the Old Testament, everything that you have looked at, studied, and memorized, it's all pointing forward to Jesus as the Messiah. And he goes and enters the synagogues, he reasons with them, and the Jews get upset, they get a mob together, they try to kill him, and Paul gets whisked out of the city quickly. This is kind of the pattern that we see. We saw it in Philippi. The Jews get jealous, they chase him out, and Paul leaves, and he goes to Thessalonica, goes in the synagogue, preaches the gospel. The Jews get jealous, chase him out. He has to be whisked to Berea. Now he gets to Berea, begins to preach the gospel, open up the scriptures, and it says that people in Berea were very receptive. They were going back and examining the scriptures daily to see if what he had said was so. So this is different. Now, these people are receptive, but the people in Thessalonica heard that the people in Berea were receptive, so that mob that was there followed him to Berea to try to kill him there, and he had to be whisked out of Berea at night and sent to Athens. Now, so think about this. It's easy to read these stories and think, okay, Paul, right, he's this Superman, kind of Goliath figure in the Bible, but Paul was a dude, okay? He was a guy. He was a man. He was a regular human being, and he was literally on the run for his life. There were mobs of people who were chasing him, and if they caught him, they would beat him, throw him in prison, or even try to kill him. Like, this was his reality. So it's hard for us, I think, to picture that this even happened, and that even more so, this happened to him. So this begins to affect you after a little while. So Paul's gone from city to city trying to not die. That's kind of his goal as he goes and he's preaching the gospel. And then he gets to Athens, we saw in chapter 17, and he goes and he's going to wait for Timothy and Silas to come, but then he looks out and he sees the idols in Athens, and he's provoked. He's stirred deeply to anger, and he says, I can't just wait. I've got to go and get to the synagogue. So again, he goes to the synagogue. He's reasoning with them in the scriptures. He goes into the marketplace in front of the philosophers, and he contextualizes his message beautifully to their understanding and their cultural context. But even at the end of Athens, even almost worse than them going, hey, Paul, I understand what you're saying, and if it's true, it changes our lives, and so I'm going to come after you and kill you. The people in Athens responded and were just like, oh, okay, that's cool that you believe that. That's sweet. We'll see you maybe on Tuesday, whatever. And they didn't really have a response at all. And that apathy is almost even worse than anger, because at least the people that were angry understood the weight of it. They were saying, hey, if this is true, it changes everything. The people in Athens were just like, oh, whatever, that's cool. We've got a lot of other philosophies that we live by. And it says at the end that not many people believed. And so Paul leaves Athens now, and you can imagine, he's gone from city to city, running for his life, and he gets to Athens, and he puts everything he knows into contextualizing the gospel, and nobody responds. And then he walks into Corinth, and he's tired, right? He's a guy. He's scared. There have been people who have been trying to kill him, and he just left a context where people didn't even respond to what he had to say. And not only that, but he's alone, right? He still hasn't met up with Timothy and with Silas. And it's not like Paul can just get on his iPhone 1, which wasn't around back then. Okay, I know the 6 just came out, but the iPhone 1 wasn't around then. He couldn't just go and check in and see what Timothy and Silas were doing and be like, oh, look, they're leading us tweet. They're on their way from Berea coming to meet me. Like, he was separated from them. There was no way to get in touch with them there, and he was just alone and tired. And he enters into the city of Corinth, and you can imagine he's just exhausted. Right, and so I try to think, like, what is it in our lives that can breed that kind of exhaustion in our lives? And while we can't come close to this, the closest thing I could think of being that tired is being Disney tired. And everybody knows what I mean. And I will hold to this until the day I die, that there is no kind of tired in our lives like Disney tired, where you go by yourself, just by yourself, okay? You go with some of your friends who are young and lively and have a lot of energy, and you go from open to close at Magic Kingdom, and you get to the end of that day, and you cannot wait to get in bed. It is a glorious thing to walk in and get underneath the sheets and just go to sleep, and your feet are praising you for finally getting off of them. And that's with our friends. Now, have any of you ever gone to the parks with family before? And then you begin to enter little children into the equation. And it takes Disney tired, which was already at an exponential high, and now raises it to an infinite amount where you thought there is no way that we can make it through this day with the children screaming and crying and wanting to ride a ride. And you go and wait in line all day long, and they get to the very end of the ride, and you've been waiting there for 2 hours, and they get to the ride, and they go, you know what, I actually don't want to ride it. And you just go, we have been waiting this whole time so you can meet this person, now you don't want to meet them anymore. And there's frustration, and there's anger, and you're exhausted, and there's nothing like it. Nothing like it. And so I thought about it with when our family came to town, and we had our 3 nieces and nephews, 6-year-old boy and 2 4-year-old twins. And the littlest boy, right, he's adorable and has the most tender heart I've ever seen in my life, but he is crazy. He is wild, and I love him to death, but he was going all over the place, going 100 miles an hour all day, and he was just exhausted. And if there's anyone, if you look out at kids at Disney and you think, is there anyone more tired at these parks than these kids? All you gotta do is just look at their parents, and they're more tired than these kids. But this boy, his name is Ramsey, was going 100 miles an hour all day long. And we get to the end of the day, we were at Hollywood Studios, and he has just had a day. He's throwing fits, he's tired, he's hungry, and we get to the end, and all day long he said, I want to ride Tower of Terror. We're like, I'm 40 inches tall, and I can ride it, I want to ride it. And we're like, Ramsey, now it's scary. You had a hard time in the Great Movie Ride, I promise. This is a little bit above this, so just take it easy. But he was like, no, I want to do it. I'm brave. He's got that little boy in him that says, I'm brave, I can do it. And so he wants to ride, but we know, Ramsey, you are tired, you are hungry, you are worn out. And then we go wait in line, and there's the spooky music playing, there's the mist coming in, and he begins to also be scared at this point. He's now terrified, but he knows now he's committed, right? He's a guy, so even at 4 years old, he knows, I've said I'm going to do this, I'm going to have to do this. But in this moment, while we're waiting in line, he is tired, he's exhausted. He had to leave because his brother and his sister didn't want to ride it, so he's alone, and he is terrified. And all of those emotions are similar to what Paul is feeling in this moment. As he is beginning to walk into Corinth, he is tired, he's exhausted, and he's scared. And he's walking into a city, Corinth, that was known for its sin, is known for its ability to give you whatever you wanted on this world. So it was kind of the what happens in Corinth stays in Corinth. That was its context. So if you look at the map, you'll kind of see, you can barely see right there where Corinth is. The black on each side of that is water. So it was actually a port city on each side. Oh, that was magical, Keith. Nice job. On each side, it was a port city. So from both sides, sailors from across the world were docking and coming in. So if you've seen Pirates of the Caribbean, you know how crazy that pirates and sailors can be. And so this was part of the culture that Paul was walking into. It was one of the most debaucherous cultures in the known world. To say that you acted like a Corinthian was one of the worst insults that people had during this time. So Paul is leaving. He's tired, he's exhausted, and now he's about to walk into a place where there's anywhere you would think, man, this gospel message won't take root. It's in Corinth. So this is kind of as we're walking into it now in chapter 18 where Paul is. So verse 1, chapter 18, on page 602. After this, Paul left Athens and went to Corinth. And he found a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to leave Rome. So Paul gets to Corinth and he walks in, and immediately he's greeted by 2 people, Aquila and Priscilla. They were husband and wife, and they were kicked out of Rome by Claudius in AD 49, and they had now found their way to Corinth. So Paul, immediately at the end of a long journey, tired, exhausted, and hungry, God places 2 people right in his path. And look as they continue what they began to do. And he went to see them. And because he was the same trade, he stayed with them and worked, for they were tent makers by trade. So Paul gets here and he meets these two people. Not only were they Jews who had become Christians, but they also did the same thing that he did, which was make tents, which I guess was popular back in that day, to be a tent maker. And so he lived with them and he worked with them. So Paul, you can imagine, all right, if you've ever felt lonely, right, if you've never been in a room full of people but felt alone, that to have one or two people in your life who know you, who you can do life with, it makes all the difference in the world. Friendship and community is such a comfort to us. We weren't meant to live this life alone. And so here, Paul, at the end of a journey that is exhausting and tiring and scary, God brings this community and these friends right next to him. And he lives with them and he works with them. And he makes tents, who wouldn't want to make tents in that day? That sounds so great. So he continues in verse 4. And he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath and tried to persuade both Jews and Greeks. So here now, okay, we see, okay, he's beginning to get back into his strategy where he goes into a city and he didn't do it first. He waited here and was encouraged by friendship and community. And now he's beginning to go to the synagogues every Sabbath and again try to reason through the scriptures with them. Verse 5. When Silas and Timothy arrived from Macedonia, Paul was occupied with the word. Man, what a beautiful phrase. Paul was occupied with the word. This is how Timothy and Silas found him. And how cool would it be for people to describe that of us in our lives? They say, what about this guy? I mean, what do you know about him? I hadn't met him yet. And they would say, well, he's occupied with the word. She is occupied with the word, that our thoughts, our conversations, our worship, our prayers, everything, we are occupied with the word of God. What a beautiful, beautiful phrase that I would love to be more and more true of my own life. So Paul was occupied with the word, testifying to the Jews that Christ was Jesus. And when they opposed and reviled him, okay, so here we go. We're beginning to see this pattern come back up. Paul preaches the gospel. The Jews, they're getting more jealous than Nick Jonas, and they oppose and they revile him. And they're saying, okay, it's beginning to start again. They're going to get together and come against him. So when they opposed and reviled him, Paul shook out his garments and said to them, I've never been angry enough to actually shake my garments at someone, but Paul was pretty upset here. And he said, this is what he said to the Jews here, your blood be on your own heads. I am innocent. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles. So Paul here is just had it. You can hear the frustration in his voice. He's gone from city after city, synagogue after synagogue, opening up the scriptures and reasoning with them and saying, look at Jesus. Everything was pointing forward to Jesus. He is the Christ. He is the Messiah. And after presentation, the Jews would get jealous and they would come and they would try to kill him. And he was done with it. He was finished. He wasn't going to do it anymore. They opposed and reviled him. And he said, you know what? Fine. You go your own way. I'm going to go to the Gentiles. I'm not even going to bother with you anymore. If you're going to keep coming at me and keep trying to put me in prison, I'm not even going to deal with it anymore. I'm going to leave you and go to the Gentiles. And maybe then you'll see just what you're missing out on. And he's frustrated. You can see that he's just at the end of his rope. He doesn't even care anymore. He's saying, I'm going to leave. And so he continues, and he did. He left there, and he went to the house of a man named Titius Justus, who was a worshiper of God, and his house was next door to the synagogue. Now Crispus, the ruler of the synagogue, believed in the Lord, together with his entire household, and many of the Corinthians, hearing Paul, believed and were baptized. And so Paul leaves the synagogue, and he goes literally right next door, and he begins to preach the gospel to a Gentile there. And then we see the gospel begin to be believed. People were believing and were baptized. But Paul he's fed up, he's frustrated, he's tired, and he's lonely. But this next part, Look at what God then tells him in this moment. Whenever he is afraid, whenever he's tired, when he's exhausted, God comes to him in verse 9 and 10 and tells him this. And the Lord said to Paul one night in a vision, do not be afraid, but go on speaking. Do not be silent, for I am with you. And no one will attack you to harm you, for I have many
in this city who are my people. And so here, God comes and he meets Paul right where he is. Paul is frustrated, he's lonely, he's exhausted, and he's scared. So God starts and he says, Paul, don't be afraid. Now, you don't have to tell someone, don't be afraid, unless that person is in fact afraid. And so we see here, Paul was scared. He was afraid. He was afraid of what? He was afraid to go on speaking. So God told him, no, Paul, don't be afraid. Go on speaking. Don't be silent. And so I don't know about you, but it brings me comfort to know that Paul was afraid. That a guy who wrote half of the New Testament, this kind of superstar of the faith, if you will, that he was a guy who at this moment was scared. And in that moment, God had to come to him, had to come even to Paul and remind him, Paul, don't be afraid, but go on, continue to speak, continue to tell people about my son, continue to raise up Jesus Christ as better than anything that this world has to offer, and do not be silent. And so I don't know about you, but I've learned a thing or two after being married for a little over 2 years now that if my wife comes to me and she's feeling emotional, maybe she's feeling lonely or beginning to struggle with anxiety, my response shouldn't just be, hey, all those feelings that you feel, just don't feel those. It'll be fine. Just stop it. Stop. This is not a big deal. Just stop. All the anxiousness and anxiety, just bury those and just choose something else. I've learned, unfortunately, through practice that is not the best response in how to talk to a woman. The woman emotional complex is a little bit more intricate than that. It's not quite just you can choose to stop feeling something. And so here God is telling Paul, don't be afraid. Go on talking and don't be silent. And he hasn't quite addressed the emotion of what Paul is dealing with. Now, if that's all God said, then that would be enough. God could just have said, Paul, just stop. Just stop it. Stop feeling all those feelings. But he doesn't stop there. See, God is a God of comfort. He is the great comforter. And what God says next addresses exactly where Paul is. He says, Paul, don't be afraid. But he doesn't stop there. He said, why? Why shouldn't you be afraid, Paul? Because I am with you. And now we see that this story that we hear often at Christmas, the story of Emmanuel, the story of divinity becoming humanity, that this is not just a story, this Emmanuel, God with us, is not a story just for December, but it is a story for all of our lives. It is a reminder that we have to constantly be reminded of that, yes, God is with us, that he has not abandoned us, he has not forsaken us, but he's in fact right here. And that truth that we have to be reminded of brings so much comfort. Do you hear the fatherly affection in the voice of God here talking to his child who is scared? And I think back to the moment whenever we finally make it through the whole line of Tower of Terror and Ramsay is he's excited and nervous as all in one. And we finally get onto the ride and he's shaking and he's grabbing onto my arm and his fingernails are digging into my skin. And we begin to go, and I don't know if you've ridden Tower of Terror before. If you haven't, spoiler alert coming up, so just heads up. It goes up and you think you get to the top right here at the beginning. You think it's about to drop, and then right before you think it does, the doors open and you go forward into this like weird room that has glass breaking and eyeballs. And you're like, this is kind of weird, Tower of Terror, Twilight Zone stuff. So you're going through and then you get to the end of it. And again, more doors open and you enter into it. And it's here and it's completely dark. It's completely silent. And there's that moment right before and I can feel his grip getting tighter and tighter on my arm. This little four-year-old boy just scared to death. And then in a moment, it shoots up. And it's beautiful because Tower of Terror, you know, it's different every time you ride it. There's an algorithm, but what's always the same is that initial shoot straight up, you get to the top, and then you fall. And so it shoots straight up into the air, and we get to the top in that moment where the doors fling open and light finally comes in, and you can see again. And it's that moment where your stomach starts to turn, and you have about a half second before you fall again. And in the moment, as the doors fling open and light comes in, I can feel Ramsey, my nephew, grab my arm and look up at me and go, Uncle Caleb, is it over yet? And inside, my heart just breaks. I'm like, Ramsey, we haven't even fallen yet. We've got like three more things before we're done, buddy. But all I could think of in that moment was to look at him and say, not yet, but I'm right here.
And if you've ever been around a child that's scared, is that not often the most comfort that you can give him? Hey, I'm right here. Whether it be a kid who's scared of a monster under his bed or is having nightmares and comes and snuggles up in between the covers between you, that in that moment you just hold him and you say, I'm right here. It's what a parent tells their child, and it's what God tells his child here. He says, Paul, I know you're scared. I know you're afraid. I know you've been running for your life, but listen, I am with you. Don't be afraid. Continue to speak. Don't stop. Do not be silent. Why? Because I am with you. And he continues on. He doesn't stop there. He says, and no one will attack you to harm you. And so here, God is giving Paul a very specific promise while he is in Corinth to say, Paul, while you're here, I know that you've been running for your life, but here, while you're in this city, no one will attack you. No one will harm you. I promise. Because we can even see it's true later on in Paul's life. He is attacked again. He dies a martyr's death. This is not a promise that God is saying for the rest of your life, no one will ever attack you. If you would just believe in me and have faith, everything will go great for you. That is awful theology that is often taught within the church, and it's just not true. But God here is saying very specifically, Paul, while you're here, you won't have to run for your life. While you're here, I will protect you so that the ministry and the gospel can take root here. And so it's a very specific promise for him right now. And he continues, he says, for I have many in this city who are my people. Now that word right there, for, is a very, very important word when it comes to reading the Bible and studying it. For, so, therefore, because, all of those words, conjunctions, are very important because they're connecting thoughts to each other. And here he's telling Paul, do not be silent, continue to preach the gospel. Why? Because I have many in this city who are mine. And God is telling Paul something very specific here. He's saying that, Paul, as you go into the city of Corinth and you walk through streets that are filled with sin, if you walk through streets that are filled with people trying to fill their hearts and their affections with things of this world, Paul, there are people here who are mine. There are people here that I have set aside for my own. Paul, there are people here that you don't have to go and try to convince to believe the gospel, but I have already chosen them to be mine. You just have to go and tell them, because they won't believe if you don't go and tell them. How can they believe if they don't hear? And how can they hear if no one goes and preaches? But God is telling Paul, if you just go, you can go with the confidence to know that these people are already set aside. They are mine. You just have to go and tell them. And so I thought about a story. Now, I'm not a farmer by any means, obviously. I'm not a farmer, but I am from Louisiana, so I grew up around farmers. Now, I don't know if anyone here is a farmer, but I would imagine more than likely not. So, but if you were, okay, so I want you to follow along with me. Let's pretend that you are a farmer by yourself, and you are going to buy a field to farm in. And you walk up to this farmer, and he's like, yeah, I've got a field for sale. It's perfect. Let's talk about it. And so you go up to him. He says, okay, in this field, I will tell you that there are certain parts of it that are completely, they're fertile. So if you plant seed in it, it will grow, and it will grow beautifully. Now, there are other parts of the field that aren't fertile. If you put seed in there, it won't grow at all. And you're like, okay, that sounds great. Can you tell me where all of that is in the field? And he's like, no, I can't. Sorry, I just know that some of it is, some of it isn't. And then he just leaves. And you're left with this field. Now, here's the question. If you were the farmer of that field and you had seed, how would you seed that field? What would you do? You would put it all over the field with the confidence to know, okay, there are parts in this field that will grow and others that won't. But it puts in you a desire to go, I will put it everywhere. And it also puts in you a confidence to know that it will grow where it is fertile and it won't where it isn't. And it's similar as we go and we preach the gospel. God has told us there are many in this city who are mine. There are many in this world who are mine. And then he leaves and tells us, okay, now go and spread the seed. And where do we spread the seed? We spread it everywhere with the confidence to know that in some it will grow and in others it won't. And we leave now with Paul and we see that he is both comforted and he's given confidence here in this message from God. And we see that in the city of Corinth, in the city of debauchery filled with sin, that even here God moves.
And it begins to take the burden off of us to feel like, okay, it's up to me and what I say and how I say it and how relatable I am and how well I contextualize things, whether or not people will in fact believe. But when we see that the power of the gospel is in God's hands, that he is the one who brings life. We're the ones that brings the message of life, but he is the one who brings life itself. And we understand that. Then it takes the burden off of us to have to try to convince people, and we can go with confidence. And then all of a sudden, there isn't this spectrum of savability where we look and we go, okay, this person, there's no way they're gonna believe. This person, maybe, like, they're close, they come to church sometimes, I bet I can go and try to, like, trick them into coming and it's gonna be great, but this guy, way too far gone. It blows that out of the water because we see God here says, no, it doesn't matter about how often they come to church. It doesn't matter about any of that. It matters about whether or not I speak into their hearts and I speak light into where there was once darkness. And so we can go with the confidence with the people in our lives, no matter who they are, no matter what our past is or what their history is, knowing that when we share with them the gospel and the good news of Jesus Christ, that he has already set them aside as his, no matter where they are. If they are his, they will believe. And there is no scale of how savable someone may be, but that we can go with confidence knowing there is no one beyond the reach of the arms of the gospel. No one. In our own hearts, no matter how far we may wander, it's just as true as for the person who maybe is completely off of this world. Just look at Paul's life. Paul was a terrorist in the Middle East who was killing Christians. It sounds familiar and similar to what's going on now. And God took him, changed his life, and he wrote half of the New Testament. There is nothing that God cannot do. And may we always remember that and not think that it's just up to us, but we rest in this promise. We rest in the confidence of the boldness that God has given us and also in the comfort that he is with us. And this gives us fuel for mission. It gives us confidence in mission. We see that Jesus himself at the end of Matthew, in Matthew 28, 19 and 20, the Great Commission, he tells his disciples right before he ascends to heaven, he says, go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you. And behold, I will be with you always. That even here we see that this promise of God with us is not just for December, but it is for all of our lives. And it is the fuel and the comfort and the confidence as we go in mission to try to fulfill this great commission that Jesus is with us always, that we remember that he is the one doing the work as we spread the seed, that we spread it, we plant it, we water it, but God is the one who gives the growth. And so we remember this as we begin to leave here, that God with us is our comfort through mission. So as we are provoked by the idols in our culture and driven to then spread the gospel to the people around us, that we would be reminded of this truth. So maybe we came in tonight and we felt, you know what, I don't know what difference I can make in the people's lives around me. There's nothing that I can say to my friends in work or the people that I live with or the players on my team or the people in my school. There's nothing that I can say. There's no way that they would believe. I honestly, if I was transparent and honest with myself, it terrifies me even thinking about having to say anything to them. And if you're anywhere close to that tonight, hear the words that God told Paul as it's spoken just as true to you. He says, do not be afraid, but go on speaking and don't be silent, for I am with you. And no one will be able to separate you from the love that I have for you. Nothing. For there are many, many in Orlando who are mine. But they will not believe unless they hear. So let's go and tell them. Let's pray. Father, thank you so much for this time to be able to come and look at your word, to see the hope, the comfort, and the confidence that we have through the truth that you are, in fact, with us.
So God, help us to remember that constantly, that we would not be afraid, but that we would rest in that truth, that you would remind us of that truth. God, that we would go from here into our jobs, into our workplaces, into our lives, and we begin to fulfill that great commission to go and make disciples, knowing that you are with us always. Thank you so much for saving us. Thank you so much for dying on the cross, Jesus Christ, and for saving our lives and for being with us. And it's in your beautiful and precious name I pray. Amen.